Now, from Mayo Clinic, it's Medical Edge Weekend, the only show that gives you the chance to ask your questions to Mayo Clinic experts. Plus, we'll take you beyond the headlines for in-depth discussions of what developments in medicine mean to you. Information you want from specialists who know. Join the conversation by phone, through our blog, or on Twitter by going to radio.mayoclinic.org. Now, with this week's program, here are your hosts, Dr. Tom Shives and Tracy McRae.
From the Mayo Clinic, Rochester, Minnesota campus, I'm Tracy McRae. Dr. Shives is away for the week. Welcome, everyone, to Medical Edge Weekend. Breast cancer. It's still the disease that women fear more than anything else, even though it's not at the top of the list. It's not even in second place of diseases that will kill American women. Still, 234,000 women will be diagnosed with breast cancer this year and will need to undergo treatment that might include surgery, radiation, chemotherapy, along with all of the worry and inconvenience and disruption of their family and social life. A lot of worrying goes along with that as well. And the next chapter is sort of a new frontier, the genetics of breast cancer. Using the genetics of both the patient and the genetics of the tumor to battle the disease. Today, I'll be joined by breast health expert from the Mayo Clinic, Dr. Sandhya Pruthi. We'll discuss the blood test that helps to assess genetic risk and the options that it gives to physicians and patients for preventative therapies to reduce risk. One of those options being the prophylactic or preventative mastectomy. Recently, Angelina Jolie, the actress, brought this to light after discussing her decision to do just that. Breast surgeon Dr. Valerie LeMain is going to be joining us to talk about that angle of the story. And we'll also talk about the social network angle of this topic. Following a recent article in the Minneapolis Star Tribune, Dr. Faris Tamimi, the medical director of the Mayo Clinic Center for Social Media, will join us to discuss if social networks such as Facebook and Twitter are providing much needed information or if they're just fueling hysteria about breast cancer. We've got a lot of ground to cover, so let's get started. Dr. Pruthi, welcome to the studio once again.
Thank you for having me, Tracy.
Do you even know how many times you've been here?
I don't recall, but it's been for many years.
Yeah, when I found out Dr. Shives was going to be away, they said, do you need a co-host? And I said, no, Dr. Pruthi, she'll be a fine co-host and a guest rolled into one.
Thank you.
Well, there is a lot to talk about today, and of course we can't cover it all, but the newest frontier is the genetic piece of it, and the BRCA1 and 2, the BRCA mutation. Let's start our conversation there. How has that changed breast cancer diagnosis in patients?
Well, it's certainly helpful when knowing that somebody has a higher risk of having breast cancer. We can guide and customize and individualize their treatments better. And this is information, but it's not new. It's been there for years, and it's been 15, 20 years ago when women could test for this gene. What has happened recently with Angelina Jolie's story is that it's brought it more to the forefront, which for many reasons is a good thing, so that people are more aware of the awareness of this test being available. But I think what's even more important is getting information about your family history. And I think Angelina Jolie's perspective on family history has really helped us start asking more questions.
I think when Ronald Reagan was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, Dr. Peterson would say that that just blew the lid off of the whole Alzheimer's talk, because people really didn't want to talk about it before that. They didn't want to talk if their family was being diagnosed. They didn't want to know. But when he said, I have Alzheimer's, I know that changed everything. I would assume that Angelina Jolie talking about this will be a huge shift for breast cancer, I don't know, diagnosis and treatment. Would you agree?
I would, but there's been patients who've been aware of their genetic mutation going back many years, and so they had to make these decisions long before what Angelina Jolie has brought to light. And so I want to give credit to many women who've known about their mutations and how they've addressed their own treatment options. But what Angelina Jolie's story has brought to light is prophylactic mastectomies is an option for a very high-risk individual, and there is good data showing that procedure does decrease the risk of breast cancer, and pretty significantly. But not everybody is appropriate for that procedure.
And we will talk about the surgical aspect of this after the next break when we have Dr. LeMain on. But one of the reasons why Angelina Jolie did this was because her mother died of ovarian cancer in 2007. This week, her mother's sister, so her maternal aunt, died of breast cancer just this week. And she also was a BRCA1 mutation, just like Angelina Jolie has been. Do you suppose that part of me thinks that it maybe will make women a little more nervous or frightened to say, I should do this. I should take this dramatic step because my mother had breast cancer.
Right. Again, here's where understanding the age of the diagnosis of the affected relatives, the types of cancer, breast, ovarian, colon, patterns that fit with the genetic predisposition, those are the ones we really want to be differentiating for who is ideal or a candidate for the prophylactic mastectomy. But there are other options as well. Preventive therapy with medications such as tamoxifen for preventing breast cancer. Surveillance with MRI and mammography is also being used quite a lot more now with watching women who are at high risk for early detection. And these women do just as well as women who've had a mastectomy. So we really need to be sitting down with our patients, educating them, making them aware of what their family history puts them at what degree of risk, and then individualized treatment based on that individual, not what Angelina Jolie did, is not ideal for everybody.
Sir, and one of the things that she wrote in her op-ed piece last month was that she could have also had her ovaries removed. What difference does that make when it comes to battling breast cancer?
In Angelina Jolie's situation, it definitely is an important procedure to be considering, not only because her mother had ovarian cancer and at a young age, Angelina Jolie carries the BRCA mutation, the BRCA1, where ovarian cancer has a higher risk of developing compared to in a BRCA2 situation at a younger age. So her process of, and thinking about when she's going to have that procedure is very appropriate, and I wouldn't think that she's going to delay that option. I have a feeling she's going to be doing that procedure pretty soon, because ovarian cancer is harder to treat, harder to follow. There isn't a good surveillance like what we can do with breast tissue. We can follow it with MRI or mammography. We can't do that very well with ovarian cancer. Also, removing the ovaries doesn't only reduce her risk of ovarian cancer, which is a significant issue for her with her history, but also can prevent breast cancer if done before age 50. So that's another thing that I think Angelina Jolie, considering this procedure, is very appropriate.
Let's talk also about the SNPs part of this, because maybe women are familiar with the BRCA, the BRCA mutation, but SNPs is a new thing that we're just starting to hear about. So explain that to us.
So I think of it more like a genetic spelling mistake. So that's what SNP stands for, single nucleotide polymorphisms. It's kind of like a flag of something going on at the gene that may increase your risk of developing cancer. And hopefully soon we will have a blood test that can identify these SNPs and help us stratify who's at higher risk. Very different from the BRCA1 and 2 mutation, where we know that specific gene is associated with a higher risk of breast and ovarian cancer. These SNPs kind of are more in a grouping. If you have 15 or 20 of these SNPs, you may be at higher risk of developing breast cancer. And again, becomes another tool in our physician's ability to assess breast cancer risk and help us individualize who's a better candidate for preventive therapy and not necessarily have to have a prophylactic mastectomy.
Are we at a spot where instead of having a mammogram, you would just go and have a blood test?
No, not at all. Mammograms are extremely important still for early detection of breast cancer. We know that it's when shown to reduce the death from breast cancer, and so it's still a test for early detection. The blood test is more in the concept of preventive. If we could identify early who may be at risk, is a different concept than early detection.
And MRIs is relatively new on the scene. For a few years now, you've been able to use that tool as well. How is that different than mammogram?
So an MRI is magnetic energy, and a mammogram uses X-ray. And so what we are able to do with MRI is detect findings in the breast that may be harder to see, especially in dense breast tissue, and it uses a contrast to help differentiate the normal from abnormal tissue in the breast tissue. It is a more timely procedure. It's a more costly test compared to mammography, and not everybody is meets the criteria for having an MRI. And so we need to do risk assessments, and we identify people like the BRCA mutation carrier would be an absolutely appropriate group to be screening with MRI. But somebody who tells me their mother had breast cancer at 80, no other family member, she should continue with screening with mammography every year beginning age 40.
It's time for a short break. Coming up, we'll continue this conversation with Dr. Pruthi, and breast surgeon Dr. Valerie LeMaine is going to join us as well. Plus, myth or matter of fact, 5 to 10% of all breast cancers are hereditary. Myth or matter of fact, we'll get the answer coming up. And right after the news at the bottom of the hour, we'll take your questions for Dr. Pruthi at 507-282-1234 or go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. You can tweet us at any time too, hashtag Mayo Radio. We'll be back right after this. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Medical Edge Radio. Our guest is breast health expert Dr. Sandhya Pruthi, and breast surgeon Dr. Valerie LeMaine is going to be joining us in just a moment as well. Let's take care of our myth or matter of fact right away. Myth or matter of fact, 5 to 10% of all breast cancers are hereditary.
And that is a fact. So a small percent of breast cancers are hereditary. That means the other 70, 80% of breast cancers are sporadic, and we don't know what causes these breast cancers. The very small percent that does, that we do know of, are related to this BRCA1 or 2 mutation.
Let's go back to Angelina Jolie for just a second, because one of the things in the op-ed piece that she wrote after she disclosed about her surgery, her double mastectomy, was that she has the BRCA1 genetic defect, which gives her a 65% risk of getting breast cancer. But later on in her piece, she goes on to say that her chances of developing breast cancer have now dropped from 87% to just under 5%. So do you know? I mean, I don't know if you hang out with Angelina Jolie or not. How does she get from 65% to 87%? That is a fairly significant jump.
And that's been one of the, I would use the word confusion from her article that has people talking about how was she able to identify this level of risk? And it's quite high than what we quote. The way that it's often described by physicians when I'm talking to a patient is your risk is anywhere between 40 to 80% lifetime risk. And I'm not sure where you fall on that 40 to 80% because we're still learning the penetrance or the degree that gene is associated with breast cancer. And for Angelina Jolie to put herself at that higher end, it's still unsure how she was able to get that information. Certainly, there are risk estimates that people can put your family history and the age of the diagnosis, the number of affected relatives into these models and come up with numbers. But those are very estimating. It's a form of estimating risk. It's not a definitive number, which Angelina Jolie somehow received from somebody.
Sure. Let's do another myth or matter of fact. And this is obvious based on what you just said, but all women with that BRCA mutation, whether it's BRCA1 or BRCA2, will develop breast cancer.
And that is a myth. Not all women will develop breast cancer. And this is one of the challenges with the breast cancer gene. It depends on the location of the gene, on the genome, and even your lifestyle reproductive factors can modify this penetrance of the gene. And this explains why some women get breast cancer, some get it later, and some may not get it at all.
We're already getting quite a few tweeted questions to us. And one of them I'm going to read to you is, what are the leading thoughts about the causes for the increase in breast cancer rates lately? So first of all, has there been an increase in breast cancer rates?
It really hasn't been an increase. There's actually been a slight decrease in the incidence of breast cancer over the years. And we're trying to kind of get our hands on what are the factors that are associated with this. And one of the most common ones is hormonal exposure. And we all know that in 2009, when the Women's Health Initiative did a large study looking at hormone therapy and breast cancer risk, that was when at that time many women stopped taking hormone therapy because of the association with breast cancer risk. And interestingly, the incidence curve showed a decline in breast cancer. So that's been one of the factors that may have been associated with the lower risk of breast cancer, or lower incidence of cancer. Another one is preventive measures. People's changing their people are changing their lifestyle, weight again after menopause, alcohol use, obesity are all factors that can also increase your breast cancer risk, and making lifestyle changes can reduce it.
And is there something to be said for people just being more frightened, as this tweet would kind of lend itself to be?
I think there is always going to be an associated fear or being frightened by breast cancer. It is a cancer that for some women is can be a harder cancer to treat. There are different types of breast cancers. And so people are kind of concerned about which cancer they're going to get, and the kinds of treatments with the chemotherapy, the side effects of dealing with these medicines. That does put some fear into these women. But we're doing a better job at treating cancer. And fortunately, our medicines are better, more effective. And so that's the hope I wish people could take from this whole breast cancer fear.
Would it be fair to say that, I don't have a frog in my throat, excuse me, would it be fair to say that because of so much work getting the word out about breast cancer through Susan G. Komen walks and pink ribbons and such, that does lead to people being more frightened because it is more... It's just seen more often? Does that make sense?
It can be more frightening because they're hearing about it all the time. It's always in your face. You kind of see the pink ribbons everywhere, and that month of October goes on for 30 days with a lot of awareness. And so for some people that does, you know, they get tired of hearing about a lot of that and the fear of, you know, what if it could happen to them. It is also important to have a sense of some awareness because it does lead women to be more proactive about if they found a lump, they would bring that to their attention to their physician sooner. I think that's one of the things I like about the awareness because that's part of early detection. Getting a mammogram is, again, important for early detection, all of which can improve your prognosis.
And let's just move along to I mentioned at the very beginning the genetic ramifications of the tumor itself. So how do we use the genetics of the tumor to help fight cancer?
I mean, this is a very exciting area, and Mayo is doing a lot of fascinating research in this area where we're trying to understand that genetic makeup of the tumor and how it responds to the medications we give to patients, and so that we're treating the patient with the right drug at the right time. And I think that's what patients want to know. How do you know this medicine is going to work for my cancer?
A tweeted question that we had was, what is a good diet to help reduce your risk of breast cancer?
You know, it's again, here it's about maintaining a healthy weight. And if that means reducing the fat in your diet consuming more vegetables, fruit, are some of the research in this area has been interesting. The main issue here is not putting on weight because obesity is a risk factor not only for breast cancer but other cancers and even, of course, heart disease, which happens to be the leading cause of death in women today.
That's right. So breast cancer is not in that number one position, nor I was looking stroke, lung cancer, respiratory disease, then breast cancer. Mm-hmm. So it is a little bit farther down the list, which is good. Mm-hmm. Very good. What age group do you tend to see breast cancer diagnosis rates occurring mostly?
So most breast cancers occur when women are over the age of 50. So 75% of breast cancers are going to occur over the age of 50 and 25% under the age of 50.
All right. A myth or matter of fact, breast cancer is primarily a genetic disorder.
Again, this is a myth.
And so I'm just concerned, I guess I think about the younger women that are going to get mammograms now. Are we going to continue to say younger women should get mammograms?
No. Here again, younger women have a lower incidence of breast cancer, and that's fortunate. We don't see as many as we do when women are after the age of 50. So for younger women, and that by that I'm going to define as under the age of 40, this is again the importance of awareness. If you feel a lump or you notice something different on your breast exam, or you have a very strong family history, you should be talking to your doctor about what type of specific individualized surveillance and preventive options you have. But they are not going to start screening mammography. On average, women should start at age 40 yearly if they are at average risk.
There was a time a couple of years ago that we heard, oh, we don't need to start at 40. We can wait a little bit. How has that advice kind of shaken out over the last couple of years?
It's still a very controversial area. And if you took 8 major organizations in the United States, one of includes the American Cancer Society, the American College of Radiology and Obstetrics and Gynecology, the College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, you would be shocked. They are still recommending screening mammography at age 40 yearly. And then the U.S. Preventive Task Force, the American Academy of Family Physicians are recommending waiting till age 50. So you've got a split here, and you can imagine the confusion it creates for our patients. And here again, I want my patient to be informed about these are the benefits of mammography. We know that there are some risks. You may be called back for additional views. You may need a biopsy, which may possibly not lead to a cancer diagnosis, and these are what we call a false positive. But the awareness to the patient to know that there are benefits and risks, and they understand, they should be able to make the decision then should they have the mammogram or not.
And are your patients okay with the phrase, I know you and I have joked about it, but the phrase watchful waiting? You know, when you find something on a mammogram that is there, are patients okay with doing that?
With finding something and not pursuing it? No, they want to know that it's been checked out and you go the next step if we have to do an ultrasound or a biopsy. I think it'd be very anxiety-provoking to be doing the watchful waiting option.
You're listening to Mayo Clinic Medical Edge Radio. Our guest is breast health expert, Dr. Sandy Apruthi. Coming up, this week's medical and health news with Vivian Williams. And right after that, we'll take your phone calls at 507-282-1234. Comments and questions from our website, too, radio.mayoclinic.org. And your tweets at hashtag Mayo Radio. This is Medical Edge Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Hi, I'm Vivian Williams with headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. High blood pressure is a pretty common issue for older people. What can you do to prevent it? Well, eat right, exercise, keep your weight down, talk to your doctor about medications, and help people. That's right, volunteer. Helping others can protect you from high blood pressure. Now, this is according to new research from Carnegie Mellon University. It shows that older adults who volunteer for at least 200 hours per year decrease their risk of hypertension or high blood pressure by 40%. The specific type of volunteer activity was not a factor. It was more how much time you spent doing it. Now, how does helping people help blood pressure? Researchers say there's strong evidence that social connections promote healthy aging. This study was published in the journal Psychology and Aging. And in other news, in the largest study of its kind, Mayo Clinic researchers found that people who have obstructive sleep apnea, when a person stops breathing for periods during sleep, have a greater risk of sudden cardiac death. Mayo Clinic cardiologist Varen Somers says your risk of sudden death increases almost twofold, particularly if you stop breathing more than 20 times per hour of sleep and if you have severe falls in oxygen saturation during sleep. Here's Dr. Somers.
So in summary, what we found that was new was that the presence of obstructive sleep apnea, particularly if you have severe falls in oxygen saturation during sleep, was a predictor of a greater likelihood of sudden death. If you have sleep apnea, or your wife or husband has sleep apnea, this study is not a reason to worry and panic and be concerned, but it certainly is a reason to be circumspect about what to do next.
Talk to your healthcare provider about your next steps if you have obstructive sleep apnea. And the study was published in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology. And now some news about our kids. A new study of the genetic origins of dyslexia and other learning disabilities could lead to earlier diagnoses and better treatment. That's according to researchers at Yale School of Medicine. In a news release, they report many students now are not diagnosed until high school, and at that point, treatments are less effective. Now, they looked at information from more than 10,000 kids. They identified genetic variants that can predispose children to dyslexia and language impairment, increasing the likelihood of early diagnosis and more effective interventions. They say findings help to understand the process, and with the new info, they hope to be able to offer treatments to kids before they get into reading difficulties at school. And that's a look at headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. I'm Vivian Williams.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Medical Edge Radio, information you want from specialists who know, on air, online, and on iHeartRadio. It's time for you to join our conversation. Contact us by phone at 507-282-1234. Go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org, or tweet us anytime at hashtag Mayo Radio. And speaking of Twitter, I want to talk about the social network angle of things. And to do that, we have on the line Dr. Faris Tamimi. He's the medical director of the Mayo Clinic Center for Social Media. Good morning, Dr. Tamimi.
Good morning. How are you doing today?
Very good. Yesterday, there was a piece in the Star Tribune, the headline being, and we do have this on our website, so if you want, you can find it there at radio.mayoclinic.org. The title of it being Mastectomy Debate, Much Needed Information or Fueling Hysteria. And this has to do with Facebook bowing to public pressure because previously they had said that they were not going to allow post-mastectomy photographs on the site. But there was a patient who took that challenge on, and this week Facebook allowed that. And I just have to wonder, something that is also brought up in this article here, does that type of exposure bring information, much needed information, to the debate, or does it fuel hysteria? What do you think, Dr. Tamimi?
Well, you know, I think when patients share stories with other patients, it's the most powerful connection they can experience, because their lived experience of enduring and surviving a disease cannot be met by us as physicians who have not done so. And doing so in a network like Facebook has real important power. You have to understand that in the United States, of time we spend on the Internet, 1 in 7 minutes is spent viewing Facebook. So the audience that can be engaged and reached is really quite striking. From a numeric standpoint, Facebook now has so many members that it's the third largest country on the planet.
Well, certainly you don't need to have Facebook. You could just Google mastectomy photos or something along those lines. But when I brought this up to Dr. Pruthi, you didn't maybe agree with Dr. Faris.
It's not that I don't agree. I am glad that the power and the knowledge of using social media can give our patients the information to make decisions. Unfortunately, sometimes you have to understand the context of this information. And just going back to Angelina Jolie's story and how she talked about the mastectomy procedure and the great outcome she had, that's not always the case, and sometimes it can be misunderstood. And some women, their mastectomies and multiple surgeries, reoperations, don't go as smoothly, and there are complications that don't get described as well. And we can confuse our patients about these options and cause more anxiety. And so that is why I often tell my patients when I diagnose them with breast cancer, don't go on the internet. I can give you the information I want you to read, good resources that I know have been vetted by colleagues, versus the internet where there's so much information, it could be overwhelming and frightening.
I think you can't overlook, though, the community aspect that Dr. Tamimi brought up, that does give you, other people are going through the same thing. That's what my surgery could look like. That's what could happen. Dr. Tamimi?
No, I think Dr. Pruthi is quite right. I certainly would not advocate for Facebook to represent the intimacy of a patient and provider discussing the appropriate clinical management in a clinical encounter. Having said that, there's profound power in shared stories for people who have had lived experiences that can be quite challenging. And seeing others endure what can be a scary and terrifying disease with dignity and courage, I think the echo message that has, particularly in a social network, is profound. It's really quite powerful.
Dr. Faris Tamimi, the medical director of the Center for Social Media, you've got a great Twitter handle. How can people follow you, Dr. Tamimi?
I am at Farris Tamimi, F-A-R-R-I-S-T-I-M-I-M-I.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us.
Have a lovely day.
All right. Bye-bye. And now on the line, we have plastic surgeon Dr. Valerie Lemain with us. Good morning, Dr. Lemain.
Good morning. How are you today?
Very good. Glad that you could join us. We're talking about a Star Tribune article that, as I said, says, is it much needed information or fueling hysteria? One of the things that I note in this article is that it says women increasingly are opting for preventative double mastectomies. That procedure jumped 188% from 1998 to 2005. I would hazard to guess that you have seen that in your practice as well.
Yes, indeed. I have definitely seen this in our practice, and as well as all my colleagues at Mayo Clinic and at other institutions. I think that women are now more informed and have access to a lot of information, and there is definitely a lot of anxiety in knowing that you may have a higher risk of breast cancer. And so with all the information available today, women are definitely seeking bilateral risk reduction mastectomies.
What are you able to do for women today that you could not do 5 years ago or 10 years ago?
There are two main options for breast reconstruction in women who choose to have a unilateral or a bilateral mastectomy. The first option involves doing a breast reconstruction with implants, which can be done in one stage or in two stages. The other option is to use your own tissue, using your own skin, fat, and sometimes some muscle, either from the stomach, the back, or the thigh, or even the buttock area, to create a new breast.
When I read Angelina Jolie's op-ed piece that she posted last month in the New York Times, I did not know that surgeons could save the nipple and remove the rest of the breast. How in the world do you do that?
Indeed, this become an increasingly more popular surgical technique that we call a nipple sparing mastectomy, where through several different incisions on the breast, depending on your breast size and if you've had other surgeries in the past, we are able to basically preserve the entire skin, including also the nipple. It's however important to specify that this option is not necessarily available to everyone, and women should discuss this with their breast surgeon who will be doing the mastectomy and also their plastic surgeon.
Is that the direction that more of these surgeries will go, do you suppose?
It's definitely an option that we do offer to every patient when we think that they are a candidate for this type of procedure. And I think that obviously women, as they are more and more informed, are definitely interested in trying to preserve them everything, the breast, skin, including also the nipples, because it definitely makes them feel more, quote-unquote, normal.
What did Angelina Jolie's op-ed piece, what difference did it make to your patients that you saw in those following days?
Interestingly, at Mayo Clinic, I have not heard a lot of patients bring up to me the Angelina Jolie story, although I have to say that what she has undergone is definitely the reality of many of my patients at Mayo Clinic, but we have not really discussed this in the office.
What do you see happening in the future for women who go through bilateral or unilateral mastectomy?
Well, we definitely will continue to offer implants and also the other form of reconstruction that we call autologous tissue, using your own tissue. I think certain trends that we have seen over the years is that implants are becoming more and more popular across the United States. And so I think both techniques do have a place in selected cases, and every woman should definitely discuss this with her surgeon in order to make the best choice for her particular situation.
Are you more able or better able to spare a breast with a lumpectomy?
That's a very good question. I would say not necessarily, because when women have had a lumpectomy, there is always radiation therapy that has been part of the procedure. And this can make the reconstruction options slightly more restricted for patients, and then we may have to guide them sometimes more often towards flap reconstruction using your own tissue than towards implants.
Dr. Valerie LeMaine, thank you so much for your time today. We appreciate you calling in.
Thank you so much.
Very good. We're taking your phone calls also at 507-282-1234. Susan has been patiently holding on the line. Good morning, Susan. Go right ahead with your question.
Yes, I can hope I can make this real quick. My granddaughter is 40. Her mother died at 42 of breast cancer, and her mother's mother also had breast cancer, and her mother's sister. Also, on her father's side, her two aunts had breast cancer, but they lived, they had at a young age, but they didn't die from it. My question to you is, should she be having mammogram, the MRI, or would this test, this BCR test, which I understand is very expensive, I think it was quoted at $3,000, but then they came back on and said that it had been lowered somewhere. Also, tamoxifen, I read where in the Mayo Clinic said there is a genetic problem with that also with some people.
Yeah.
A lot of questions. What do you think, Dr. Ruthie? That's okay.
Yeah, no, no, it's good. And you did a nice job of giving me a quick summary. What is your daughter's age?
40.
Yeah. So this is a good time where this your daughter would benefit by meeting with a breast doctor who specializes in doing a risk assessment. And we go over the ages of the diagnosis, who's with the breast and ovarian cancer, who was diagnosed, which side of the family. And we have very helpful models to help identify calculate her risk of getting breast cancer, and then use that information along with the family history to decide if she should speak with a genetic counselor about the role of genetic testing, and then discuss again using these same numbers what is the plan for her with surveillance using MRI with the mammogram to screen her for breast cancer versus proceeding with something what Angelina Jolie did. So there's a lot of good stuff your daughter has here with options, but meeting with somebody in this area who's an expert in sort of going through these models and deciding what's right for her is probably the next first step I would want her to take.
Well, she's not local. That's the problem.
and she doesn't
want to discuss it with me, and that's another problem.
And she doesn't have to be local. There are breast centers across the country. There are genetic counselors that she can find through her primary care provider, but she needs to have that conversation with her physician so she can get a better idea of what her true risk is.
Did they lower the cost of that BRCA test?
No, it's called the BRCA test,
yes.
The mutation. No, it's still at around $3,000.
Okay. Would insurance pay for that?
Insurance is covering the cost of this test. And again, based on the family history and the amount of detail on how high risk you are, insurance companies are looking at that through these models we use to estimate risk to tell you this is someone we would cover the test for.
Well, she works for Bill Gates, so I don't think there'd be a money problem there.
Then she needs to go back to Bill Gates and get that test covered.
Thanks for calling, Susan.
All right, thanks.
Thank you. We just got a tweeted question that talks to what Susan just mentioned. Is it true that there's only one place that performs that BRCA test?
At this time, yes, there is the company is known as Myriad Genetics, which is where the test is performed. And even at Mayo, we send the blood that we draw here to Myriad Genetics for the BRCA gene testing to be performed by this one place. And that's kind of where it stands right now. And obviously there's been some stuff in the news about the patent on this test. And if hopefully other places could one day be able to offer this test would be really, I think, important to our patients.
This company wants to patent that BRCA so that they can be the only place that does do this. And hopefully that will not be the case much longer.
Right.
And that may then in turn drive the cost down as well.
I agree. I think that'll play into the cost of the test.
A tweeted question, what statistics are there for people of African descent or African Caribbean descent? Do you have any statistics there?
Well, that's a great question. And yes, African American women actually have a lower incidence of breast cancer compared to white women. And unfortunately, for African American women, their mortality is higher when diagnosed with breast cancer because they tend to be more aggressive cancers with more different aggressive features to the breast cancer. So this is another group where early detection is very important, and getting the mammograms and knowing if you found a lump, getting that checked out. So again, your prognosis is better with early detection.
Our final question comes from John. Good morning, John. Go right ahead with your question.
Yeah, I lost my wife to ovarian cancer about a year and a half ago, And my daughters are interested in getting genetic testing. They're in their early 20s and late teens. And I'm wondering if that's a appropriate age, or what do you think an appropriate age is for testing?
That's an excellent question, John, and I get this often about the family, the age of when to start considering genetic testing. And I definitely would want to have your daughters meet with a genetic counselor, because this discussion about when's the right time to test and what are they going to do with the information when they get it, and how is it going to impact their next steps in their life, and the timing at which they want to make certain decisions about prevention and taking their ovaries or doing these prophylactic procedures. I really would like, even at the 20-year-old, to start talking to a genetic counselor about the test itself. What are the limitations and what are the benefits of testing? And then she needs to make that decision. I would wait on the daughter who's in her teens. She really should not be talking about this right now. It's so overwhelming to be putting that young girl through that discussion. I think waiting until her early 20s is very appropriate to talk to a genetic counselor. But with their mother's history, they have they need to be informed and get the counseling information about the gene. Is it appropriate for them, and when to do the test?
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for calling in, John, and we're sorry for your loss. That is the new decision that people have: should I get tested? So aside from that, let's finish up. We have about 60 seconds left here. What is it that you want people to know about the risk factors of breast cancer?
So we really have a few well-known risk factors that have been identified through research over the years. And the most common one is age. The older you live, the higher the risk of getting breast cancer. But there are other risk factors, including the use of hormones, the reproductive risk factors, having a pregnancy late in your life, having someone who has a late menopause is a risk factor. So we really have to pull all those together. Problem is, they're not all additive. You can't say if you have this plus this plus this plus this, you're going to be at higher risk. We just look at the whole group of risk factors and base that on, yes, this is someone who really needs to be more under the surveillance or the preventive option using tamoxifen to guide them, to help them understand where their options are. So really, there's a good number of risk factors out there. Your doctor can talk to you about them and help you decide based on that pattern what your options are.
The first point isn't that you go get your genetic testing done. The first is that you assess your risk.
Exactly. And remember, the other thing I really remind patients is that the gene test is most effective when it's done in the individual who's had the breast cancer. So it's not the test you just order on somebody without looking to see who's the right person in the family to test. Here again, the genetic counselor has an important role to play.
Dr. Sandhya Pruthi, thank you so much. Thanks to everyone in our audience for listening, and a special thanks to those who joined into the conversation. We always appreciate hearing from you, and we're glad that you joined us. You're listening to Medical Edge Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Coming up, we'll tell you about next week's program. Stay with us. Welcome back. Next week, well, you know what, before we get to next week, let me just say that if you want more information on breast cancer resources, go to mayoclinic.com. Dr. Pruthi has many articles there that you can access, and also the Mayo Clinic Guide to Breast Cancer, a book that with all the latest information. And our website has got the articles that we were referring to during the program. That's at radio.mayoclinic.org. Okay, next week on Medical Edge Radio, we'll talk about allergies and asthma with Dr. Gerald Volchek. Allergy season, well, I don't know if there is an allergy season. It's for some people, it's year-round. We'll talk about how to manage seasonal allergies when we talk about allergies and asthma. How important is it to know what you're allergic to? How many people have a food allergy? And how do you even know for sure if you have a real allergy? Plus, the latest on asthma, why it's becoming more common among children and adults, and what are the latest and best ways to treat it? We hope that you'll join us. Dr. Shives will be back next week as well. For more information on topics discussed in this program, please visit our website, radio.mayoclinic.org, where you can access a podcast of today's program, as well as previously aired Medical Edge Radio episodes. You can also go to mayoclinic.com, where over 3,000 physicians, scientists, and researchers from Mayo Clinic share their expertise to empower you to manage your health. You're listening to Medical Edge Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Our senior producer, Ron Petrovich. Our associate producer and phone screener, Audrey Castletine. Our technical director is Kim David. The theme music was written and performed by Chip Davis of Mannheim Steamroller. For Mayo Clinic Medical Edge Radio, I'm Tracy McRae.
Any medical information conveyed during this program is not intended as a substitute for personal medical advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical information you want from Mayo Clinic specialists who know.